Okay, good evening. It is Tuesday, March 8th. Husu in the Talmud. Today's topic is Rav Meir and Elisha ben Avuya, otherwise known as Acher. Decided to give this its own week. I mean, Elisha ben Avuya or Acher is a, I guess, kind of well-known individual, in terms of a personality, because as we're going to see, he serves as an archetype for a rabbinic heretic. And we do have some discussions about individuals who were from and then didn't become from, like someone who went and became a Sadducee, a Tzaduki. But Acher is one whom, if we consider, went off the derech, completely went off the derech. Might be familiar with a book As a Driven Leaf, which is, the best way I can put it, is a midrash on Acher, where the author sort of fictionalized Acher's life with his own dilemmas and stuff. Might be interested, but realize that it is primarily a piece of fiction, kind of sort of corresponding to Gemara. It's not straight out of the Gemara itself, though we're going to see that, we've been talking about here too, that the Gemara itself might not be adequate as a historical document in its own right. But at any rate, interesting to consider. And it's important to discuss this with Rav Meir, because Rav Meir was a student of Rav Elisha ben Avuya. And in the passages that we're going to discuss today, we're going to see a little bit about not only Rav Elisha ben Avuya, but also Rav Meir's relationship with him. Elisha ben Avuya isn't mentioned that often as Elisha ben Avuya. He's mentioned once in Pirkei Avot, which I didn't cite here, and Acher a couple of times. There's an instance in the Gemara of a kid who is told by his father, go climb a tree, chase away the bird. He goes up to climb the tree, falls down, and dies. There's one of that story is written twice. One opinion says that Acher saw that scenario and that's how he decided to go off the path. That's one instance. We're going to be discussing here, for clarity's sake, Gemara in Chagiga, primarily page 15a and b, that really goes into discussion about Acher. So we're going to go through one primary source. What isn't mentioned here that requires just a little bit of background? It's in the second chapter of Chagiga that discusses a bit of the mystical tradition in Judaism, for lack of a better term. It starts, about Ein Dorshin, certain things that you're not allowed to teach in public, or at least to even certain individuals, and one of them is Ma'aser Merkava, the works of considered the creation, or things that go on in heaven, or technically creation would be Ma'aser Bereishit, but Ma'aser Merkava refers to things of like the supernatural metaphysical nature. You're not even supposed to teach that to one person, but rather you drop hints, and the wise and the discerning would go and be able to figure it out on their own. There's so much written on that alone. And here, this passage that we're going to be discussing requires just one little bit of introduction, a statement that you might come across several in the future. Tano Rabbanan, Rabbi Sotna Braita, Arba Nichnasu Bapardes. There were four who entered the orchard. Literally, Pardes is an orchard, but there's a metaphor used here for some sort of spiritual type of study.
Here?
No, you are not. This is actually from 14b, page or so earlier, but I'm just including it as a preface. And the four people were Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Acher, and Rabbi Akiva. And the Gemara then discusses, all of their, the experiences behind them and what happened to them. So now we pick up a couple of pages later on 15a, where it begins of Acher kitzets bin tiot. It says Acher mutilated the shoots or the roots. Let's see how the article translates that little thing here. According to the article translation, it's Acher chopped down the saplings in the orchard. So the first few things of the translation here, which again are simply those copied and pasted, about cutting down the shoots or whatever, is a continuation of the metaphor of going into an orchard, right? Idiomatically, it means, he basically questioned or left the faith, all right? Jane, continue with the reading. Acher mutilated the roots.
Acher mutilated the shoots.
Shoots, sorry.
Of him, Scripture says, "Suffer not thy mouth to bring thy flesh into guilt." Kohelet 5:5. What does it refer to? He saw that permission was granted to Metatron to sit and write down the merits of Israel. Said he, "It is taught as tradition that on high there is no sitting and no emulation and no backs and no weariness. Perhaps God forfend that there are two divinities." Thereupon they led Metatron forth and punished him with 60 fiery lashes, saying to him, "Why didst thou not rise before him when thou didst see him?" Permission was then given to him to strike out the merits of Acher.
All right, so stop there for a second here. Do you follow what's going on here so far?
Yeah, Metatron is the angel that sits above the throne.
Well, right. It's interesting. Did I include the footnote? Yeah, I did there. Bakalan out, backsliding children, except Acher. So, first off, this Metatron character, which film buffs may recall from the movie...
Tron?
No! Not Tron. Dogma. Yes, played by Alan Rickman, who gets really annoyed at Bethany for not knowing Metatron because it wasn't in a movie. Yeah, right down to see Dogma. Good movie. Notice I included here a footnote from the Cencino here that according to our passage, Acher was guilty of the heresy of dualism. L. Ginsberg denies all historic worth to the story given here, when it says denies historic worth would mean even as idiomatically, which on account of its reference to Metatron, which he declares to be a specifically Babylonian idea, and its lack of connection with the introductory words, he declares to be of late origin. So according, Ginsberg prefers the parallel account in Yerushalmi Chagiga 2:1, where it's related that when Elisha saw a scholar, he slew him, that he enticed the young man from studying Torah, and that he informed against the Jews when they sought to perform the work they were ordered to do on the Sabbath in a matter not to break the law. These events undoubtedly refer to a period of the Hadrianic persecutions. In the JT referring to Jerusalem Talmud, two reasons are mentioned for his apostasy. According to some, he saw one man break the precept of Deuteronomy 22:7 without coming to harm, and another observe it and get killed. According to others, he saw the tongue of the great scholar Reb Judah Nachum in the mouth of a dog. The Jerusalem Talmud also gives different versions of the verses discussed by Elisha and Reb Meir, and what Reb Meir said on his master's death. So what he's pointing out here is that, according to Ginsberg, there are other accounts of Acher and Reb Meir, and in terms of what would have happened to make him go off the derech. According to him, this idea of Metatron, for whatever this might be, and we'll leave it as an open question, he says, is a Babylonian idea, whereas if Rav Elisha ben Avuya would have been a teacher of Rav Meir, would have made him a Tana, would have put him squarely in Israel, and would have made a lot more sense historically if he would be thinking in terms of someone from Israel, and not in particular during the Hadrianic persecutions. And the story, or not the story, but the narrative given in the Yerushalmi seems to be a little bit more rationalistic. Okay? Again, you know, we met when I introduced this about taking even this Gemara as a historical account might not necessarily be so accurate. Doesn't mean that it's false in a sense that the intent of including it here might not be so much to explain here's exactly what happened, because let's face it, if Rav Elisha ben Avuya or anyone else saw an angel of God, how would you go about recording such a thing? Meaning, was there another observer who saw this taken down, who's, you know, writing this by way of history? Are you doing like a first person teaching behind it? So keep that in mind. It's an important consideration. Alright, so now continue. Bat Kol went forth.
Bat Kol went forth and said, "Return, ye backsliding children, except Acher.
meaning Acher would not be able to repent from his sin.
Thereupon he said, since I have been driven forth from yonder world,
i.e.
no share in the world to come, let me go forth and enjoy this world. So Acher went forth into evil courses. He went forth, found a harlot, and demanded her. She said to him, art thou not Elisha ben Abuya?
Abuya, yeah.
But when he tore a radish out of its bed on the Sabbath and gave it to her, she said, it is another.
Acher. Right. So this is how, you know, according to this narrative, is how Rav Elisha ben Abuya got this term Acher. And who this refers to. All right, so first talk about this for a bit. What do you think really made him go off the derech? And what was it that really did him in?
Conflict.
Okay, what sort of conflict?
There are two divinities.
Okay. Right, so if you want to say that there are two divinities here, what did he do and what did he say exactly? Now, keep in mind, this is open to, you know, a certain degree of interpretation.
Well, he, just by saying that there are two, God forbid that there are two divinities, he just questioned the unity of God.
Okay. And therefore?
And therefore he doesn't...
Well, think about this way. So let's take it in an abstract level, and according to... oh, wow. This is actually pretty interesting. Worthwhile reading. This is a reading from the footnote in the art scroll here. And I say this is interesting because it involves a certain level of scholarship that you wouldn't necessarily find in an art scroll. It says, Elisha ben Abuya reached beyond his mental grasp. He attained a perception that he could not readily assimilate within his system of theological assumptions. Therefore, he jumped to a conclusion, abandoning for a moment the cautious reasoning these issues demand. Mar Nevuchim 132. Why the Well, this is where our scroll kind of gets under my skin, when he's holding Elisha ben Avuya, a Tana, accountable by virtue of the Mar Nevuchim of the Rambam, which came...
Well, isn't it just the Rambam retelling it?
No, we're reading the Gemara now.
No, but oh. In the footnote, I mean.
Oh, I see. Oh, that could be it. All right, possibly, in which case I retract my criticism of the art scroll. But normally would footnote it better. Well, anyway, the conclusion to which he leaped was the false and heretical belief of dualism. Rav Hai Gaon, cited in Hakosev and in Otzar Gonim Teshuvot, states that Acher's heresy was akin to the Zoroastrian beliefs of the Magi. They believed in two gods, Hormis and Ahriman, one a god of good and another source of evil, one a source of light, another a source of darkness. Acher apparently recognized Metatron as a secondary and lesser god, see below. Thus, the specific form of dualism to which he subscribed seems similar to Gnosticism, the belief in one's superior god and one inferior god. Now, this, I mean, the fact that they're actually referencing Zoroastrianism is, I think, really impressive in its own right. Two, it makes the footnote that I included here from Cincino about, from Ginsburg, to drive the point home. Because Zoroastrianism wasn't an Eretz Yisrael phenomenon. Wasn't in Israel. It was in Babel, Babylon, Persia. Right? So, if anything, I think it's a good interpretation of the Babylonian spin, perhaps, over what would otherwise have been in the Jerusalem Talmud story. At any rate, the message behind it seems to be a little bit different here. What he says, or at least, you know, he's asking here, Shema Chash V'Sholem Shtei Rishiyotein, perhaps heaven forbid, there are two authorities, God and Metatron, or two other beings, right? Then they... you know, set upon him, you know, things of fire and lash, and, you know, you're basically holding him accountable and saying he has no share in the world to come just for asking the question, right? What? Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, he's also, he's a Tana. He's on a slightly different level from the rest of us.
Okay, and therefore?
He's held to a higher standard.
All right, so one way of reading this is we're going to hold that to a higher standard that even if he just asks the question, he just doesn't have that leeway, right? Now, according to, you know, the art scroll explanation here, you know, it's that he reached beyond his mental grasp and that was a problem. But you would think that Atana, you know, might be able to, you know, achieve that,
well,
perhaps.
Is it also possible? I'm figuring that if the other story, Shiloh HaKan Kigurad thing,
yeah,
happened around the same time, he's probably having a real bad day. And logic kind of went beyond faith for a moment.
Well,
maybe
one
more than a moment.
Well, one step at a time. And if, let's say we operate under the assumption that this passage here is an anachronism, which I think, you know, either based on Ginsberg's thing at the bottom here from Metatron, or, you know, Rav Haig Gaon referring to the Zoroastrianism, it could very well have been that a Babylonian source, that this wasn't necessarily historical as much as a metaphorical warning to the people of their day against dualism of Zoroastrianism. Right? I think that's a plausible assumption. I mean, well, it could be. You know, it's a way of interpreting it, and the point being that, one, even someone as great as Acher can make this mistake, and B, the mistake only it needs to be is theological, where just by asking the question, you get kicked out of the world to come, and not only kicked out of the world to come, but there's no possibility of tshuva, and what's Acher's reaction? Well, if I'm not going to get Olam Haba, I might as well enjoy Olam Hazeh. Right?
It's fair.
Well, you say it's fair. What else do you think could have been expected?
Well, clearly he was pretty traumatized by whichever of the events, whether it's the Shiloh HaKan.
Well, let's set that one out to the side, because one, it's not in this passage, and two, even when that passage is related, one has Acher and the other doesn't. And
okay,
it's a possibility there.
So I just figured he started out having a bad day.
All right. Okay, that's.
And you know, things.
All right.
Things got to him, and his capacity for faith had just been exhausted that one particular day, and logic overtook faith, and there it went, maybe.
Okay. Alrighty, so let's keep things going here. However that was set up, however he became, I mean, what does seem to be known is that Elisha ben Avuya at one point did go off the derech. The Yerushalmi has a different version of why, but we know that he did in terms of action.
Why does it say they led Metatron forth?
Be referring to the angels, I would guess.
Okay.
All right, Dana, take next paragraph.
After his apostasy, Acher asked Rav Meir a question, saying to him, "What is the meaning of the verse, 'God made even the one as well as the other'?" He replied, "It means that for everything that God created, he created its counterpart. He created mountains, created hills, created seas, created rivers." Said Acher to him, "Rabbi Akiva, thy master,
Rabbecha, your teacher,
did not explain it thus, but as follows: he created righteous, he created wicked, he created the Garden of Eden, he created Gehenna. Everyone has two portions, one in the Garden of Eden and one in Gehenna. The righteous man, being meritorious, takes his own portions and his fellow's portions in the Garden of Eden. The wicked man, being guilty, takes his own portion and his fellow's portion in Gehenna." Rav
Misharsheya
said, "What is the biblical proof for this? In the case of the righteous, it's written, 'Therefore in the land, i.e. paradise, they shall possess double.' In the case of the wicked, it's written, 'And destroy them with double destruction.'"
Okay.
Okay.
So here we've got an incidence. This is after Acher left or did whatever, according to the language in the Hebrew, Ishayatza Litarbut Ra'ah, ways of straying to the bad. You know, he went to the dark side. We're going to use this, you know, Manichaeism, dualism, but I think you're light and dark. All right, so he went to the dark side. He's still asking Rav Meir a question. Right? And he's asking him in I mean, first off, it's fascinating that he's asking him a question of, like, what does this pasuk mean? Two, it seems to be more rhetorical, because he's asking him, like, hey, explain to me this pasuk. And Rav Meir gives an answer, and he says, your own teacher didn't explain it this way, which means, no, you didn't learn it correctly. What do you think this tells you?
Ignorant stuff.
Well, clearly. I mean, people who just go off the derech don't become ignorant. My sister, you know, had conversations with one of my cousins in Israel, who had studied in yeshiva before the war. Now irreligious, but the way he said in the yeshiva, he still knew stuff backwards and forwards. You know, the old school chilonim, secular Israelis, who were educated in the old yeshiva systems, were incredibly knowledgeable. Yeah, I'll throw in the joke here, you know, for those listening on tape, like just one, well, on digital. The joke is, that I heard in the name of Ben Gurion was they asked him if he had a Jewish wedding, and he said, Lo haya kesef, lo haya shtar, which is really funny if you know the first Mishnah in Kiddushin. If you don't, that's understandable, but you read the first Mishnah in Kiddushin, you'll find it amusing. But the fact that he answered that type of question with a Mishnaic reference shows that, yeah, he might not have been so observant. In fact, he kind of said explicitly he wasn't observant with his answer.
The first Mishnah in Kiddushin, slightly offensive to some feminists, but you might want to say it anyway.
No, that's quite all right. It's one of those Maven Yavin type things.
You can look it up.
Exactly. Look it up if you're that interested. But the point is, in his joke, he's basically saying, yes, I'm not observant, and B, I know the law. But you're not even talking about law. He's talking about a certain theological statement. Now, to what do you attribute the significance of what Rav Meir, of how Acha responded Rav Meir? Because truth be told, these are, what they're saying is actually pretty similar. Rav Meir is saying God created something and his counterpart, and he's talking very naturally. Mountains, right? You create mountains, hills, seas, rivers.
Well, the way I see it is that Rav Meir says it, that the counterpart is an equal. A mountain is not equal to a hill.
Mm-hmm.
A sea is, you know, is greater than a river. And what Rabbi Aher is saying, no, what he taught was that for righteous there is wicked. So it's an equal,
it's not that there's an equal balance, but they're opposites, I think is what you're trying to say.
Sounds like he's angry.
The first part is there's similarities. The second part is that they're opposites. All right. Dan, any thoughts?
I think this may be me projecting, but it sounds like there's a lot of anger here.
Okay, explain. Am I thinking about it for a bit?
No. You ever been in the company of somebody who went off the derech and is really angry about it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And happens from time to time in the rabbinate?
Yeah, as have I. And my experience is that they generally focus on all the things about punishment and wickedness and judgment and.
Why is this necessarily bitter, though? He's saying good people get rewarded, bad people get punished. That doesn't sound bitter. That sounds just.
I think Rabbi Meir was looking at the at the nicer side of things.
Well, let me throw. I think Jane said very, very, and in fact, according to the art school footnote, the Maharsha says exactly as you say. So, go Jane.
Thank you.
Yeah. Throw out another possibility here, and again, there's no. I don't think there's a straight right or wrong answer. As we follow the assumption that this passage is a response to Zoroastrianism, then I think, you know, the analysis of Jane, like, really is a lot more relevant, because instead of saying that one is well or the other is similarities, Acher's response is no, there's good and there's bad, there's light and there's dark, which seems to be exactly the problem, or at least in terms of the interpretation of, say, Rav Haigaon, that got him into trouble in the first place. of really buying into the system. And again, the Yerushalmi has different discussions of the Pesukim. This particular pasuk, or at least in this exchange, seems to be that Acher, and also attributing this to Rabbi Akiva, no less, which you know may or may not be true, or at least could explain, you know, where he would have gotten some dualistic ideas of. I mean, not to say, look, we spent several weeks on Gehenna and Gan Eden, we spent enough time on this stuff, you know, in the rabbinic thought and theology class. But he's explaining it as specifically the dualistic side of the light and dark. Next up, Jane, take the next paragraph.
After his apostasy, Aher asks Rav Meir, what is the meaning of the verse, gold and glass cannot equal it, neither shall the exchange therefore be vessels of fine gold? He answered, these are the words of the Torah, which are hard to acquire like vessels of fine gold, but are easily destroyed, forgotten, like vessels of glass. Said Aher to him, Rabbi Akiva, thy master did not explain thus, but as follows. Just as vessels of gold and vessels of glass, though they be broken, have a remedy, they can be repaired. Even so a scholar, though he has sinned, he has a remedy, as in can repent. Thereupon,
yes, and he can, what's the remedy of a scholar? He can always repent.
Thereupon Rav Meir said to him, then thou too repent. He replied, I have already heard from behind the veil. Return ye backsliding children, except Aher.
Yeah. So this, you know, might seem to indicate, Dana, you know, where you would find a little bit of the bitterness come through. When Rav Meir says, like, what is the meaning of this verse? Rav Meir says, you know, they're hard to it's hard to acquire, but easily forgotten. Right now. You know, that's one. That's one sort of interpretation. Do you think perhaps that Rav Meir might have been giving Musar to Elisha ben Avuya? Because in a weird way, I mean, yes, it might have been hard for him to acquire it, but clearly he still knew something, and he's still recording it back, and he's giving Acher the ability to, you know. Not only offer Rabbi Akiva's response, which is, you know, they can be repaired, even though they're broken. Scholar, even if he sinned, has a remedy, except Rav Meir says, hey, but you can too. And he says, no, I already heard from behind the veil, you know, everyone can do tshuva except for me. That seems to be more the fatalistic approach. Do you think from reading this passage that he wanted to or cared about doing tshuva or not?
No.
Yeah.
He was angry.
Well, this would seem to indicate something a little bit more angry, but it also shows that Rav Meir didn't necessarily lose hope in him.
No.
And to continue this whole light-dark Manichaeism type thing, I mean, you can also think of the last scene of, you know, Star Wars. Well, Return of the Jedi, at least, you know, trying to save the soul and says, no, it's too late for me, Luke. Anyway.
Lahavdil.
You know what? I'm not sure about Lahavdil, because the whole thing about the Force being, you know, this dichotomy between the light and the dark is, you know, not. It's very akin to Zoroastrianism or Manichaeism, that type of thing, you know, that type of dualism. Granted, it gets fleshed out more outside of the movies, which, you know, after the original trilogy are generally terrible, but you get the idea. Yeah, don't pay attention. Never mind. Danik, I'm sorry. You have a question, Jane?
No.
Okay. Danik, go take the next one.
Oh, I love this one.
Yeah.
Our rabbis taught, once Asher was riding on a horse on the Sabbath, and Rav Meir was walking behind him to learn Torah. Said Asher, Meir, turn back, for I've already measured by the paces of my horse that thus far extend the Sabbath limit, i.e. past the permitted boundary of 2,000 cubits. He replied, thou too go back. Acher answered, have I not already told thee that I've already heard from behind the veil, return ye backsliding children, except Acher?
So stop here for a second.
I love it.
Yeah, so Acher is riding on a horse on Shabbat, which notably violates a rabbinic prohibition, an explicit one. Rav Meir's walking behind him to learn Torah, which means Acher is still teaching, logically. right? So just because the guy might not say be, quote, firm anymore, does seem, well, whatever he learned, he still learned. Not only did he learn, but he's also still concerned for the well-being of others. Let's not forget, l'fnei iver lo titen michshol.
Right.
One of the prohibitions is, you know, don't put a stumbling block before the blind, or don't do something to cause someone else to sin. Or, alternatively, even if he himself might have given up the faith, he was still respectful enough of those who kept the faith. I mean, there are two ways. Either he was concerned for himself, which is possible though unlikely given his second statement, that he wouldn't cause someone else to sin, but given that he didn't think that he was getting olam habar, and he didn't even think he could repent, that seems unlikely. But he was certainly polite enough, or tolerant enough, or respectful enough of Rav Meir to say, hey, you still believe in this stuff, you shouldn't be doing this, and warning him not to go outside the tzchum, not to go outside the boundaries.
The weird part of this,
yeah,
is he attributed what he heard to being behind the veil, so he didn't say, all right, all my life I've been hearing voices, this is all a sham.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that. I mean, again, when you look at that first, you know, incidence of it, you know, this was after he went through the parties of whatever, you know, that mystical thing might have been. Right?
Mm. So, but I just like that he's still referring to that when he says it. It's like he's still saying, yeah, I still believe in God.
The veil with a capital V, you mean.
Well, don't worry about the capitals. That's just Cincino being Cincino.
But isn't that where it's coming from?
That's an
interesting... Isn't that where it's coming from? Isn't it the last veil of God?
Yeah.
That's where Metatron
and not only that, but he's also citing a verse. So he's not denying the belief of God. He's sort of saying, well, all hope is lost. It's a better way of putting it.
Mm.
Yeah, good point. Continue.
Rav Meir prevailed upon him and took him to a schoolhouse. Acher said to a child, recite for me thy verse, i.e. that which you've studied today.
Just as a slight aside here, this happens like not infrequently in the Talmud as a weird way of an omen type thing. If you ask a child, what did you learn in school today? They tell you a verse that has some auspicious significance. I'm just telling you it happens a lot in the Talmud. Here are a bunch of cases.
Isn't that how Eliezer became... He shot the arrow east-west, north and south.
Ah, yeah! Thank you. All right. Yes. Remember that from the last class. Yes, thank you. It's been a while. Memory shot. Yes.
All right. Child answered, there is no peace, saith the Lord, unto the wicked. He then took him to another schoolhouse. Acher said to a child, recite for me thy verse. He answered, for though thou wash thee with... Nitra?
And
take thee much soap, yet thine iniquity is marked before me, saith the Lord God.
I just put in the citations here.
He took him to another schoolhouse, and Acher said to a child, recite for me thy verse. He answered, and thou art spoiled. What doest thou that thou clothest thyself with scarlet, that thou deckest thee with ornaments of gold, that thou enlargest thine eyes with paint? In vain dost thou make thyself fair, etc. He took him to yet another schoolhouse, until he took him to 13 schools, all of them quoted in similar vein.
I mean, what's been the general theme of, you know, the above verses?
Don't be wicked.
Well, not just don't be wicked, but a certain idiom of wickedness and the sin not being able to be removed, right? Yeah. Which kind of goes along the lines of what Acher is saying, of like, yeah, you know, basically I'm metaphysically screwed in the world to come, you know, because he has no chance of, you know, fixing his sin. Go ahead.
When he said to the last one, recite for me thy verse, he answered, but unto the wicked God saith, what hast thou to do to declare my statutes, etc.? That child was a stutterer, so it sounded as though he answered, but to Elisha, as opposed to Larusha, to the wicked, God saith, huh?
Right, so it says here, L'Rasha Amar Elohim. The pasuk is L'Rasha Amar Elohim, but because he was a stutterer, it came out as Ule Elisha, because he was stuttering as he was saying the word Rasha.
Some say that Acher had a knife with him and he cut him up and sent him to the 13th. Cut who up?
The kid.
That's awful. And sent him to the 13 schools, and some say that he said, had I a knife in my hand, I would have cut him up.
Right, without, yeah.
Isn't that...
He was a meanie.
Well, yeah, Jane?
How many people do you have to judge?
A capital case?
Yeah.
If I'm recalling correctly, 21, yeah. And they're typically not school children.
No, I know, but I'm wondering if the school children have to refer to any other of maybe of the rabbis and their positions on him.
What do you mean?
You know, if there were previous, the children actually represent rabbis that had an opinion of 9-13 and cutting up the kid.
It does say according
very,
to...
Very, very familiar to something.
Well, there is a footnote here in the article that he didn't really cut up the kid. It would be to cut up the scroll.
Oh.
Yeah.
Neither one is very nice.
No, but what are you going to do? When Acher died, he said in heaven, "Let him not be judged, nor let him enter the world to come. Let him not be judged because he engaged in the study of Torah, nor let him enter the world to come because he sinned." Rav Meir said, "It would be better that he should be judged and that he should enter the world to come. When I die, I shall cause by my prayer smoke to rise from his grave, a sign that he was judged and punished. When Rav Meir died, smoke rose up from Acher's grave." Rav Yochanan said, "What a mighty deed to burn this master. There was one amongst us and we cannot save him. One scholar went astray, yet all of us together cannot save him. If I were to take him by the hand, who would snatch him from me? But he said, when I die, I shall extinguish the smoke from his grave, a sign of forgiveness. When Rav Yochanan died, the smoke ceased from Acher's grave. The public mourner began his oration concerning Rav Yochanan thus, even the janitor of hell could not stand before thee, O master."
The janitor.
Well, again, that's the...
He says, thee and thou and has janitor.
Well, technically he's speaking in Aramaic or, you know, whatnot, but they're Hebrew. But you see, look, I'm just using translation here. Okay, so what about this? What do you mean? What's going on here about being judged and entering the world to come?
Well, I mean, despite his having gone off the derech, he still did a lot of good in his life.
Okay.
So Rav Meir said, don't set that aside.
So the implication of to be judged is to be judged negatively, right? Because otherwise you would just say, you know, according to, you know, let's say Rambam's definition, did he do more good than bad in his life? You know, or whatever. I'm one way of reading it, Rambam. And at the end, right? So it also seems that there are, you know, it would give you the impression, how many options do you think there are? I mean, it says, let him not be judged, nor let him enter the world to come, then what's he supposed to do?
Lay there.
Oh, welcome to the land of Nod.
Land of?
Nod.
Nod? A reference I am not getting.
Isn't that Nod? Wasn't the Cain?
I see that. Okay,
right?
That's what you're referring to.
That's just my own commentary. Just what I.
Okay.
You know, he's just supposed to go back and forth until somebody. I mean, Rav Meir is actually praying for him, right? In Halam Haba.
Well,
which,
yeah,
you know,
well,
we don't do,
Rav Meir,
right?
Well, Rav Meir seems to be saying that really, you know, let's assume there's something called purgatory, right? Which is neither here nor there. So right off the bat, let's assume such a thing exists, right? Limbo. So right off the bat, that would seem to go against dualism. You know, if you're just thinking in terms of literally black and white, this Gemara introduces a possibility of gray, as neither Gehenna nor Olam Haba. Rav Meir's solution is like, no, he should actually be judged, meaning go down to Gehenna for a bit, and then later, the world to come. Now, from the end here, it seems that there was smoke coming out of the grave, which is in and of itself a fairly odd sight, because, I mean, let's face it, there are a lot of people, wicked people have died, and we don't see smoke coming out of the graves.
The first.
And the smoke ceasing is also an interesting idea, because just because the smoke ceased doesn't necessarily mean he made it into the world to come.
He was just decided on.
Exactly. Because we don't have another sign to the contrary. And let's not forget about, you know, the whole pasuk that he heard from behind the veil of return ye backsliding children type thing, of interpreting that he has no share in the world to come. Well, did he or didn't he?
Well,
and of course, this also assumes certain ideas of what is the world to come, whether or not the world to come is metaphysical or some physical world that hasn't even been actualized yet, that he might be worthy to in the future.
Well, Rameir was laying at least even money that Acher, after having been judged, would still get all in my butt.
Okay. Which would be a fair assessment. You know, he punish him for the bad, reward him for the good, and don't let one necessarily offset the other. In a sense, Rav Meir is taking the position, you know, just as you might say that on a theological level, his soul might have been stuck in some limbo land, Rav Meir's answer is, life isn't black and white. Get punished for the bad, get rewarded for the good, as opposed to you're either good or bad. I mean, the whole thing with Rav Acher is once he realized it wasn't getting Olam Haba, he figures, well, once I'm on the dark side, might as well go all in.
Yeah.
Right? And it could very well be as a thematic idiom that Rav Meir is saying, no, like, you get rewarded for the good, you get punished for the bad, doesn't mean that you give up one or the other entirely.
Also, isn't there a phenomenon of the Rebbe gets rewarded for all the Torah his students learn?
I don't know of a Gemara offhand for that. Could be.
Let's assume for, okay.
Are you saying that the merit?
I figure Acher has an annuity or two or three or several hundred.
But even so, however much his merit is, you know, he's still getting rewarded for it. Forever he did bad, he's still getting punished for it. This would seem to go against the, black and white nature that it's, you know, that Acher seem to have lived by. Meaning it's not all good and it's not all bad, it's a little bit of both, and you take each one as it goes.
Well, he's saying the wicked get punished and the good get rewarded.
Exactly, as opposed to saying, well, once you're wicked, you're just completely wicked. You know, as you're not supposed to put yourself or treat yourself as if you are wicked and thus give up hope. Meaning it's one thing to say, yes, you sinned, you're going to be held accountable for your sin, right? You might not be able to take it away, but that doesn't mean that good works and good deeds are all of a sudden irrelevant.
So are you allowed to say, I'm a good person who did a bad thing? Or let's just say, does that fall within...
What do you think we do on Yom Kippur?
On Yom Kippur, we say, I'm really not worthy of this.
Well, yes, and you can argue about how we get around saying that, but yeah, that's kind of what we're doing.
I don't think so.
Well, we're definitely saying we did a whole lot of bad things.
Yes, but we're saying we did all these bad things, we're really not worthy. Lo shavala. We shouldn't have done this. We're better than that. But then again, we're really not so good, and you have to have mercy on us. So we know we don't deserve it. Give it to us anyway.
I fail to see how that's better.
It's not saying we're good people who do bad things. We're saying we're not all that great, but you said you love us, so forgive us anyway.
All right, fair point.
So I think Rav Meir is saying, you know what? He's a good guy. He did a lot of good. He fell off the derech, and okay, judge him for that, but, you know, come on, let him off.
I don't see it as such, because he's not qualifying the good or the bad. All he's saying is, punish him for the bad, reward him for the good. In no way do you see an equation of one being greater than the other.
You don't think that there's possibly an emotional component here? Or Meir said, he taught me. He was my rabbi.
Could be, you know, an emotional component there. Certainly, even going to, or, you know, going to Gehenna to achieve Olam Haba is better than, you know, an afterlife of limbo.
Also, what does it say about Rav Meir?
Rav Meir studied with him even after he went off to Dara.
Yeah, that's in two paragraphs. Jane, take to the next one.
Aher's daughter once came before Rabbi and said to him, "O Master, support me." He asked her, "Whose daughter art thou?" She replied, "I am Aher's daughter." Said he, "Are any of his children left in the world? Behold, it is written, he shall have neither son nor son's son among his people, nor any remaining in his dwelling." She answered, "Remember his Torah, the study of, and not his deed." Forthwith, a fire came down and enveloped the rabbi's bench. Thereupon, Rabbi wept and said, "If it be so on account of those who dishonor her, the Torah, how much more so on account of those who honor her?"
Yeah. So there seems to have been, yes, even though he might have sinned, you remember the Torah and not the deeds. And this is getting from, you know, the daughter. Dana, take the last paragraph, which addresses the question you asked.
The Hatter of Meir learned Torah at the mouth of Acher. Behold, Rabbi Bar Chana said that Rabbi Yochanan said, "What's the meaning of the verse, 'For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts'?" This means that if the teacher is like an angel of the Lord of hosts, they should seek the law at his mouth, but if not, they should not seek the law at his mouth. Lakish answered, "Rav Meir found the verse and expounded it as follows: incline thine ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply thy heart unto my knowledge. It does not say unto their knowledge, but unto mine. Since the heart may not be applied to their knowledge, it shows that the act of the wise men referred to must be wicked."
Okay. This is the footnote from the Sincino. "Nevertheless, the words may be listened to," meaning the fact that it says my knowledge doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't say their knowledge of the wicked people, but my knowledge. Yeah.
So,
nevertheless, their words may be listened to.
Thus, Rav Meir could learn from Acher, provided he did not imitate the latter's deeds. Rav Chanina said, he decided it from here: "Hearken, O daughter, and consider and incline thine ear, forget also thine own people and my father's house." The verses contradict one another. There is no contradiction. In the one case, scripture refers to an adult, and the other to a child. When Rav Dimi came to Babylon, he said, "In the West, they say Rav Meir ate the date and threw the kernel away."
Yeah. So, you know, basically, in a nutshell, you know, you're talking, pun for that
the
last one.
The kernel or the pit?
Whatever. You take the good and you throw away the bad. And I think, you know, this final exchange is spectacular for a whole slew of reasons.
Yeah.
One, you've got later generations that are trying to explain how did Rav Meir learn from a Rasha. And they're throwing out these verses here. So the first thing is from Rav Yochanan, who's bringing the question. The answer is from Reish Lakish, who says that you follow, you know, their knowledge, you follow my knowledge of God's, not their knowledge, which is really important for Reish Lakish of all people to say, because he was a robber for most of his life, and for lack of a better term, became a Baal Teshuva. So the fact that he's the one who's coming up to defend how could you learn Torah from a Rasha, I think, or at least from someone who went and did bad deeds, from someone who in his past did bad deeds, I think is important in its own right. And then you have other justifications to basically say, yes, it doesn't matter what this person is doing, but as long as they're teaching you Torah, you can learn from them. Which, you know, in today's society is, I think, fairly important as well. Yeah. In terms of a mashal here, because if even an author, right, who's clearly, you know, well on new stuff, to say, well, you know, he's a kofer, you can't take him seriously anymore. Torah is Torah, and if you know the difference between what's Torah and what's not Torah, fine. But to say that just because someone might not be observant, therefore they can't teach you anything, is silly, counterproductive, and according to this Gemara, incorrect. Yeah.
So, I just got a brochure from the Learning Annex. This is hypothetical.
Okay.
I got a brochure from the Learning Annex. So-and-so Reform Rabbi is giving analysis of the Talmud. He's going to teach Maseches Gittin.
Yeah.
At the Learning Annex. And he's clearly a Reform rabbi.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's every credential on the planet, studied at greatest yeshivas, and he's a Reform rabbi, and he's marketing himself as such.
Okay.
Do you go?
Sure.
If you think that the person has what to teach you in Torah, I would not have a problem with it. Case in point, we've had non-Orthodox rabbis speak here who were PhDs in their field, who weren't poskening halakha and taught Torah. And in one case, you know, people objected to statements, but based on the merits. In another one, you're talking about comparing the Bavli to Yerushalmi, and we had someone else who spoke on the evolution of the Shemona Esrei. These were areas in which people were fully competent in. I don't know. And this is also me not knowing what their religious practice is.
Yeah.
Don't know, don't care. But my take is, well, they're academics. Let's say, you know, granted, not everyone with a PhD is intelligent even in their field. But they're speaking as academics, people who've done research in the field and have what to say. Now, does that mean that I would ask either one of them halachic questions? No, not necessarily. But for things that I know that they know, they may have some information or a certain perspective that could be useful in terms of understanding. Now, does that mean you necessarily seek people out? Well, it depends on what it is that you need to know. There are, you know, hundreds and thousands of sources you can read and interpretations to find. You only have a finite amount of time to, like, seek out anyone, right? So to say that you have an obligation to, no. Do you, you know, ignore them, you know, out of hand? I would think that would be incredibly short-sighted if you know that someone's an expert in a field. Give one example. Let's take someone who, all right, let's say a Bible critic who happens to be the world's best expert in biblical Hebrew. If you have an opportunity to learn with the world's best expert in biblical Hebrew, you'd be a fool not to take it, because if you learn biblical Hebrew well, the Torah is a completely different world to open, and it's really phenomenal. The person might not necessarily believe, but the person can teach you skills that could, in fact, help you learn.
And what are the chances? Well, we don't know the chances, but is there not a chance that the world's biggest expert in biblical Hebrew might slant your thinking a little bit toward biblical criticism, even though you weren't inclined toward that when you first walked in the room?
So, well, that goes to the whole thing with, you know, you could say with Rav Meir, of you take the parts that you can and ignore the parts that...
But when you're Rav Meir, you can do that.
You mean at a certain level? So the truth is, there...
He had enough learning under his belt that if Acher started going in a bad direction...
So that what you're arguing seems to be somewhat akin to what I've heard attributed to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein about going to secular college, which is, don't do it on an undergrad level, do it on a graduate level when you've got a few more years of learning under your belt, and it's not going to be as threatening. If you do that, let's say, on a case-by-case basis, assuming you're, like, you know, super threatened by stuff, you know, fine. But in terms of the, you know, possibility, or to say that it is carte blanche forbidden to learn from this guy because he's a Bible critic, you know, look at it that way from the other extreme. Does that mean that everyone, I mean, from this story here at least, we don't know of other people learning from Elisha ben Avuya other than Rav Meir.
Yeah.
Or at least after he went. It just seems to be Rav Meir's the one who's doing this. Could be Rav Meir was an outlier. Or Rav Meir knew enough not to be influenced by it. And in which case, it may not necessarily be that, you know, it could be that Rav Meir was unique for any number of ways. But if you are set and solid in your own faith, right, then, you know, you can say, all right, this person is, you know, coming at it from a biblical criticism perspective. Fine.
Also the student kind of becomes the teacher, because Rav Meir said there's still hope for you.
Well,
which is not something a student would normally say to a teacher.
So, right, so there is that personal investment there, where he still believes that, you know, there is hope for Elisha ben Avuya and wants him to come back, too. You know, you could see that, like, if you have a mentor, you know, sort of loses faith in his own abilities and you really believe him, you can still support him, still talk about things, and maybe him learning with him could have been, I don't know, maybe Rav Meir's vision of Heter Kiruv, like keeping him engaged in Torah, and maybe he'd wake up and see the light. It's a possible interpretation. Certainly we grant that. But from the end of the Gemara, it seems to be, you know, from the discussion, is that even if that wasn't the case, if you just want to take it on a simpler level, that he was just learning from someone who no longer kept the mitzvah, seemed to be okay. Because again, just because you don't do it or don't believe it anymore, doesn't mean you can't learn from them. And we do see from Acher, and I think the case with the horse was important, was that even if he himself didn't keep the mitzvot, one, it wasn't because he didn't believe. Because the whole thing was the fact that he keeps referring to behind the veil and keeps referring to this experience that he has means that he still believes in the judgment that was rendered to him. And two, he's still respectful of the mitzvot. He just didn't care. So you might even be able to make that distinction as well of it's one thing to study with someone who is an observant versus studying with someone who is actively antagonistic towards the religion with an intent of influencing others inappropriately, which Acher notably did not do with Rav Meir, at least based on this narrative. Obviously, you know, if you show me, you might find a couple of other nuances in the story about Rav Elisha ben Avuya. But I do think, I mean, the Babli's one, studied more often. People want, I can try to get a translation of Yushalmi, and we can do that next week for comparison if you're interested. But we could be in touch about that.
You know what this is, the cutting up of the child?
Yeah.
Reminds me of
our... Nope. You want to be? Jane, I just made a phenomenal reference, which I'd love to check out. I really like that. The analogy of either potentially chopping up the kid or chopping up the scroll, depending on, you know, which interpretation it is. Or the scroll. To Pilegesh Begiva, sending out, you know, to the tribes to say, of, you know, look at how bad something is sinning, and to show that you're... I like that analogy. I it's not mentioned explicit, but I do think that hits idiomatically. Didn't occur to me. Wow, phenomenal.
But I'm still trying to figure out the number 13. I'm sure that there's a significance for the number 13.
Well, it was the 13th one that got sent to the others. So it was really sent out to the other 12.
Ah!
So, there you go. Wow, nicely done. All right. So, certain things to keep in mind, then we'll think about what to do for next week. I mean, we got time. I might need to postpone a bit and just focus on Megillah stuff. But cool. Thank you all very much. Have a great week.